It's season 3, episode 2 of the Doctors and Litigation, the L Word podcast. I'm your host, Gita Pensa. It is November 2025. Happy to be back. It's been a bit of a whirlwind month since I last talked to you. I did some speaking. I went back out to Austin. I love Austin. I did a keynote there for the National Aging Services Risk Management Conference. I went out to the University of Kansas Health System, had a great day there doing grand rounds and a workshop on developing litigation-specific peer support and a session with their department chairs about how to support their people through litigation. I did a couple of other medical society and medical staff dinners closer to home, all just really wonderful events to connect and talk with doctors and nurses and other clinicians about all of these things that are close to my heart. I am still working clinically, so it's been a bit busy, but I think in my newfound empty nester state, I might have overcommitted, but I do love it. And as you all can probably surmise, all of this work is very, very meaningful to me. So when I get to do these events, or when I get correspondence, or when I hear people say that they've shared the podcast with other people, hoping it's going to help them too, or that the podcast helped them prepare for a deposition or trial, or to meet the process with more strength or clarity or less isolation, I don't even know what to say. It's just truly, truly meaningful. So I want to thank you for sharing it. And I also want to thank you for putting the things that you learn here into practice. I just got an email from someone who said that they had a really unexpected adverse medical event for one of their patients. And listening to the episode with Rick Boothman on the Michigan model gave them the courage to show up and to walk in and to talk to the family. They came in on their day off to talk to that family. And they related that it was scary and it was hard, but they understood that it was important and meaningful, and they did it, and they were really grateful that they did do it. Okay, so on the coaching side of things, I recently had a wonderful experience doing a group coaching debrief among a set of co-defendants who had been in a very high-risk obstetrics case. And so this is a set of doctors, midwives, nurse practitioners, a whole team. And there had been a defense verdict. They won. And the truth is, after trial, even when you win, there is an awful lot to process. I actually just received some other correspondence about that. And yes, it's very true. So the organization asked me to facilitate a virtual session with them where they could really talk about what it had been like for them and how they had suffered and what they did that helped and what they'd learned and what they would do differently if it happened again. One thing that does bear mentioning is that they all said they did not realize how important their depositions would be and that they felt underprepared for them. Their depositions had been many years ago at this point, and so they hadn't listened to this podcast before that. But another very important theme, and this is what I want to focus on, was how much they supported each other in trial and how their attorneys before that had really helped them to build this really cohesive and strong defense, how each of them believed in the others and were sort of mentally holding each other up to testify well, and that there was this feeling of having won this thing together as a team, all of them having had each other's backs. And it was really a truly wonderful and remarkable session. There was a lot of appreciation for each other in that setting and the hard work that they do together every day as a team. It was marvelous. And today, we're going to talk about the opposite of that. Something that happens in medicine a lot, unfortunately, is finger pointing, blaming. It often starts after a bad outcome, reflecting the worst in us, often driven by fear or panic, not a wise attempt at disclosure, but something like a surgeon telling the family of a patient that the nurse anesthetist is really the one who's responsible for this terrible outcome. Or one consultant uses the chart to criticize another's opinion of the case. When documentation starts implying that somebody else dropped the ball, or when we use defensive language that tries to shift responsibility, that record later can become Exhibit A in a very unpleasant legal story. And in that legal story, co-defendants are often very wary of one another. Will they blame me in their deposition? What will they say? Should I try to get out in front of it? We go into self-protection mode, which makes a lot of initial sense in our fear and anger. But today we are going to talk about why what feels self-protective or righteous in the moment may actually come back to haunt us later. So today I am joined by trial consultant and communications expert Heather Hansen. For over 20 years, she defended providers and hospitals in medical malpractice cases, and then she created a 3-year curriculum for medical residents, teaching them communication and advocacy tools. She's helped leaders from Harvard Business School, Google, LinkedIn, the American Medical Association, the Hospital Corporations of America. She's helped them advocate for change, resources, opportunities, attention. And as a trial attorney, she taught thousands of witnesses how to be credible and charismatic in court. She combines her experience with her degree in psychology, conflict resolution training, and time as a TV anchor to develop her trademarked systems and help her clients achieve their goals. She's been featured on The Today Show, Dr. Oz, CNN, Fox News Channel, MSNBC, CBS, Fox Business. She's the best-selling author of The Elegant Warrior, How to Win Life's Trials Without Losing Yourself, and she is the host of The Elegant Warrior podcast, which has consistently been in the top 100 business podcasts on Apple. And once we get into our conversation, you will see why. One little side note before we get started. We talk in this podcast about collaboration among co-defendants. We do not mean you collaborating with each other on your own, okay? Remember, everything that you do related to your case, once litigation starts, goes through your attorney, okay? Okay. I just wanted to make sure there is no misconception about that. Okay, now on to my conversation with Heather Hansen. Heather, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And today we are going to be talking about healthcare providers or defendants in litigation trying to point the finger in other directions. What happens when we blame each other and sort of why we do that and things that we don't really I think instinctually don't really understand about what the implications of that are. So tell the audience a little bit about yourself and the work you do and how it is that you're here talking to me.
I have been really privileged. From the time that I was in law school, I worked at a medical malpractice defense firm. And then I became a partner at that firm over time. So for over 20 years, I defended hospitals and doctors and other providers in medical malpractice cases. And in the past few years, I have gone on to create curriculum for residents on how to advocate, how to communicate. And these issues come up primarily in my practice defending these cases, but also when we're teaching residents how to communicate and how to communicate in the chart as well.
I mean, and you've got a lot of other really interesting things in your background that, you know, make you particularly a communications expert. I feel like you're a trial consultant now. You've been working in a really tough venue. You've done medical malpractice. Philadelphia is a tough venue. I think we all know or should know that it's a tough place to be in the medical malpractice defense complex. You've been a television anchor. I think that is really interesting. And so all of these things really speak to your expertise in communication, I would say.
That's my passion for sure.
We're going to get into this issue. This is a really delicate issue because many times when we're talking about situations in litigation when there are co-defendants, but even, you know, when something bad happens and there's an adverse event, what types of communications happen where people are trying to sort of throw blame in other directions and why that happens? Let's start by just, let me ask the question. In your experience, when there are co-defendants in a single case, did you see it happen a lot that people were trying to throw other people under the bus?
It did happen a lot. And to be honest, it depended a lot of times on the attorneys. There were some attorneys who had reputations for throwing co-defendants under the bus and other attorneys who had reputations that they did not. Sometimes it was in the chart. There was charting that there was clearly disagreements among providers as to maybe a diagnosis or a treatment plan. And that sort of sets you up for that finger pointing because it's there in the chart. But other times it's not in the chart, and then it becomes an issue during the litigation process. I'd say combining those, about half the time when there's co-defendants, you see some aspect of finger pointing.
Let's back up for one second. Let's talk about the chart. Because the chart and then what happens in litigation kind of can turn into two different things. In the chart, let's say there are many times that I see things in the records where I'm looking at as, you know, an objective person sort of after the fact, and I see something and I go, ooh, ow, ooch, like, okay, like this feels bad. And it could be something like a person at an academic center is looking at what was done in the community and casting aspersions on it, judging it, saying like this was totally inappropriate care in some way. And like now that's in the record, where I would say like you weren't there. You don't know what that person was seeing or dealing with. And it's possible that things evolved. So we'll talk maybe in a minute about better ways to perhaps articulate those sorts of things. But you see like one provider, even sort of in hindsight, bad-mouthing somebody else's care. Or you'll see in the wake of an adverse event, you'll see, you know, two services blaming each other, or you'll say, you know, someone will say surgery did something, or surgery will say ER did something or whatever. Let's talk about that quickly. I think people feel like that's in some way self-protective, right? It could be like nurses blaming doctors, doctors blaming nurses. Talk to me about why this is self-sabotage.
There's a number of reasons, but I think first we have to talk about what's the chart for, right? The chart is for the care of the patient and for communicating that care of the patient. Accusing people, especially people, your first example of someone who treated the patient a long time ago, isn't going to help move the ball forward in any way. And so there are ways to document about things like that. One of the things I often say is facts, not feelings. If there's a factual thing that's going on, you want to document it. But if you have a problem with another provider, then you should bring it up the chain of command or speak to them in a quality meeting or go to their supervisor or go to the board if it's someone at a different hospital. But to bring it up in the chart, it doesn't have a place there. And it just sets you up. You know, you may think that you are protecting yourself, but actually it may get you named in a lawsuit. You've got to think about the fact that plaintiff's attorneys are trying to tell a story. And if they think that there's going to be a story of two providers fighting with each other and they can just sit back and watch, they may include you in a case that you would not have otherwise been included in.
Yes, I think people completely fail to appreciate that whatsoever. But if you seem like someone that they're going to relish calling to the stand or be able to use as leverage to like, you better drive this number up because I'm going to make your whole organization look bad, you know, you should really have another thing coming. And I think we do that sometimes. You are incensed on behalf of the patient. Like sometimes you are really mad. Like this person seems like they dropped the ball. I always try to remember, and I've been on both sides of this coin. Like I work at academic center. I've worked in community hospitals. I've seen academics totally disparage community people. And I've been on both sides of it. I get it. And we have opinions because this is the work that we're doing. And we feel very strongly about patient care and what is standard and what is A+ and what we should be doing, et cetera, et cetera. However, again, the chart's not the place for that. If you want to pick up the phone and call someone, you know, be my guest. I think that's what I would want someone to call me if they had issues with it. And then I could tell them like, well, this is what I saw at the time. I think maybe it's different than what you are seeing now, which is possible. And you don't know what they were seeing. I'm going to get off my soapbox about it. I feel very strongly.
No, but I think you're so right. And I think it's important to note as well that if you feel as though there is a threat to the community from this doctor, now you've opened yourself up for a different kind of obligation because you do have an obligation to advocate for patients. And I know you've talked about this on other podcasts, that litigation is not really the place to make medicine better. But there are places to make medicine better. And one of those places may be that when you see something that has gone wrong or not the way that's within the standard of care, to report that to someone or to bring that up somewhere. But the chart is not the place to do it.
I'm glad that we made that clear. And so, yes, dispassionate language, use facts. We've talked about thought work in other podcasts, right? Thoughts and feelings are different from facts. You're going to stick to the facts, dispassionate telling of the facts, because it is not as helpful to you to cast aspersions as you feel it might. I will say, even as an aside, I have seen some people do some great things in the chart, too. You have no idea how helpful it can be to people to actually compliment their care. I've seen ICU attending was awesome. An ICU attending documenting something that, like, excellent care from services provided. Unfortunately, these complications happened. They probably averted a lawsuit just like that, just by saying, like, you know what, this is a tough case, et cetera, et cetera. So charting can be helpful, too. You can help yourself and everybody else when charting in a way that tells the good story, too.
That's right. Without a doubt, it can be very helpful.
You're not a bad person if something like this happens or that you have the urge to do that, because I think it's human nature to want to protect ourselves when we're accused of something or if we're afraid that we're going to be accused of something. And again, we've talked all along about how fear and shame completely infuse this whole process. And since we don't understand, we don't know how to strategize within the system, we just have this like blank, abject fear of it and catastrophizing. And people do funny things when they are afraid, when they're motivated by fear. Let's talk about the psychological drivers that make defendants feel like compelled to deflect blame, even though now they're learning, I guess, that it could really hurt them.
I think that when you think about danger, right, the way that we respond to danger, I think the one that most people know, fight or flight, but there's also freeze and fawn. And those are our natural responses when we feel like we are in danger. And blaming someone else sort of falls under all four of those, right? Fighting with someone else so that you can protect yourself. Running away by blaming someone else and throwing someone else under the bus. Freezing is a little bit different, but fawning is trying to please the plaintiff's attorney or trying to please someone else who's reading the chart by explaining that it wasn't me, it was someone else. And so those are natural responses to danger and to threat, both during the time of the care at issue, but we see it more often during the time of litigation. And so you've got to sort of fight against those natural responses and allow your more evolved systems to kick in so that you're actually responding instead of reacting and thinking through your actions.
I think what will help us do this is for people to get a much clearer understanding. We've sort of outlined that it's not a good look and that it can be not helpful. But let's talk about, really break it down. How does it help plaintiff's counsel when they see arguing in the chart or arguing in depositions? How does it help them? Why does it help them?
It's a phenomenal piece of evidence. The plaintiff's attorney is telling a story to the jury. Remember that in the courtroom, everybody has the same facts and data, and they're turning it into different evidence to tell different stories. In the chart, ideally, it's a very objective documentation of what happened at the time. But if in the chart, say a plaintiff's attorney is thinking whether or not they're going to take a case and there's damages, right? It might be a brain damaged baby or it might be a paralyzed orthopedic case. They're deciding, can I make liability here? And there's a note in the chart that says this other doctor screwed up. Yeah. Well, great. They still need an expert, but they have an expert within the chart. And also plaintiff's attorneys take courses and study how to drive up verdicts. And one of the things that they study is how to make the jury feel unsafe. And so when you've got in the chart one doctor talking about another doctor, not only is it that this doctor's saying that you messed up, but also the jury's thinking, why are my doctors fighting when they're supposed to be taking care of me as a team? It also drives that story of you are not safe, no one's safe under these doctors' hands, and someone needs to punish them.
Okay. I think that there's a lot that's really important in there for people to really sort of digest and understand that the jury wants to believe that doctors know what we're doing and that we're competent and that we're not catty and that we're wise. They want to believe all of these things. And so it's not helpful to us as individuals because I think to reiterate what you said before, there's a high likelihood that you'll get yanked into this thing when you start charting like that because you are useful to the plaintiff's attorney when you do that. And then all they need is for you at trial or even the threat of it to drive up this big settlement number is the threat of being able to use your words against this other person because many times you will float or sink together. I also think in deposition, people have a misconception that this is the place where they get to, you know, tell their side of the facts and make sure the attorney knows where the blame should really rest and that if they feel themselves to be blameless, that the deposition is the place to explain themselves and get out of it.
You know, it's so hard. Depositions are so hard. The chances of you getting out of a case because of your deposition testimony are very, very slim. In all of my years, I think I saw it happen less than a handful of times. And I did this for 25 years, hundreds, if not thousands of depositions. So it's very, very rare for you to be deposed and have that be the game changer. Sometimes the plaintiff's attorney will know they want to drop you after the deposition and still won't do it.
They'll just let it drag on for a long time because they're really hoping if they distress you for long enough, someone's going to cough up some money to get you out of it.
That's right. And they're afraid that they're going to let go of the wrong person And then they're going to lose that opportunity to go after that person. So your deposition, while it is your opportunity to tell your story, it's not your opportunity to tell the whole story. I do a lot of work now preparing witnesses for deposition. I really understand how stressful it is. And we talk a lot about that and about what do you believe about yourself in the deposition, because that's so important. But when it comes to the content of the deposition, it's really important to answer the question and not go further. And I think that's one of the things that people do when they want to say, it's this other person's fault or it's not my fault. And you've really got to remember that the plaintiff's attorney is not there to get the truth. They're there to get the information that's going to support their story at trial. And so you want to make sure that you're not giving them more than what they're asking and doing their job for them.
And certainly when you're sort of opening new cans of worms in order to get yourself off the hook, I mean, they may get at, let's say there was something that happened in the OR and there's some sort of surgical misadventure. The second, the assist is actually the person that caused the problem and not the surgeon. I mean, those things are going to come out eventually, right? These are facts. You know, they're going to ask what happened, then what happened, then what happened. And you are going to have to go through a series of facts in the deposition. But again, differentiating it from your thoughts and feelings about, like, if you're like, my God, that guy was such an idiot. He did this and he did this and then he pulled the thing off. Like, let's keep it professional. How about that?
That's right. And factual, because you're right. They're going to depose not just you and your first assist, but also the other people who were in the operating room and ask about what happened. And so you want to be clear on what happened and stick to the facts, especially at deposition.
So moving on to trial, how do jurors perceive? Again, I think, you know, the perception is if we can get the jury to believe it's somebody else's fault, they won't blame me. Again, this is like a population, so we have no idea what any one individual person is going to be, but we do have a lot of data. How do, in general, jurors perceive it when co-defendants are pointing fingers at each other and blaming each other vociferously?
The defense generally will not win those cases. Now, there are times that one defendant gets hit for more than the other. Remember that these cases are not zero-sum game. What happens when there's multiple defendants is the jury has to attribute percentages of liability on the verdict sheet. What happens is everybody usually gets attributed some percentage of liability, because you'll have some jurors who say, I think it was that one, and some jurors who will say, I think it was this one, and then they'll, you know, break it down in the jury deliberation room. But ultimately, you know, you've got to go back to something you said earlier, Gita, which is that, I say this all the time, everyone on the jury is a patient. Unfortunately, I did this for over 20 years. I never had a doctor on my jury. Now, we know that that's awfully frustrating and it's not a jury of your peers. I totally understand. But because we know that everyone on the jury is a patient, we have to see the case from a patient's perspective so that we can speak to that perspective, and that's how you win. And from a patient's perspective, you want to believe that your doctor and your nurse and the resident and the midwife and the first assist, that they are a team that knows how to work together. And so when there's this finger pointing, there is a real sense that I am not safe. This is not safe. Patients are not safe. And that drives verdicts up even higher than they would otherwise be.
And they often can't follow. You bring in experts and the experts are arguing with each other as to, you know, which story they're supporting, et cetera, et cetera. And we hope that the jury has like some basic understanding of the facts of the case, but it turns out they often don't. They often cannot follow the medicine unless it's very, very simple. But when things start to get complicated and there are a number of co-defendants that all have different roles, you know, you've got an intensivist and you've got an ER doctor and you've got a hospitalist and you've got mid-level providers are also in there. It's very hard for them. They don't understand what everyone's roles are. They don't understand everyone's scope of practice. All they have to do is understand somebody somewhere in here messed up. Then it's game over.
Well, 100%. You know, my mentor used to always say that when people are pointing at each other, the plaintiff's attorney crosses their arms and sits back because somebody clearly made a mistake here. Whereas when you can collaborate on your defense, it takes more work. And I know we're going to get there. But it takes more work. But when you can do that, you often find that even if you think the co-defendant messed up, they actually didn't. And they did act within the standard of care. And part of the reason you think they didn't is because you are responding with that primitive brain of, it's not me, they must have messed up. And so we've really got to be intentional and take the time to talk to experts and work with each other and explore the reasoning for the decisions. Because most of the time when we do that, we find that there is a way to defend the case with collaboration, and therefore there's a way to win.
And so again, like, you're having these, when it's in litigation, all of that work is going through attorneys. When you are beforehand, you know, before litigation, yeah, you're communicating with each other. You're trying to get a good outcome. Honestly, this is, the phone call is a very underutilized tool these days.
100%. And it brings up an important point, because these days you see less, especially with the EMR. You know, I'm old enough to know when it used to be a handwritten chart. You could tell if somebody was mad, Gita, and they were just venting with their handwriting, you know, this doctor did this and this doctor did this. Now with the drop downs and so forth, you see that less often. But what you do see is text messages with people saying, oh my God, I can't believe nurse so-and-so did that today. She was totally useless on the floor. And then the other person saying, yeah, she's always like that. And that stuff can be discoverable
more and more and more often.
And so you are 100% right that pick up the phone and call somebody rather than be texting, especially stuff like that.
I will say, like, for some reason, like in the last year, every case that I've been involved with, every witness preparation thing, there is somebody somewhere has texted somebody something that, you know, of course, later you're going to have to clarify and defend and say why that text message makes sense. But it would be so much easier if you didn't do that.
Yeah, if you don't have to, it's better. The less you have to explain, the better.
Now we're going to get into some very specific information. People are going to have to sort of pull back from what we've talked about in the past in terms of whether or not they're in a shared defense situation or whether or not they have separate insurers and separate attorneys and that kind of stuff. So if you don't recall that, I'd say go back and listen to the episode on policies, because this becomes germane to my question now, which is, how does it change when you have multiple defendants and they have separate attorneys and insurers? What can we say then about what happens with the finger pointing and whether or not it's actually beneficial? Right? Because in this case, I guess I'll explain just a little bit, as opposed to the shared defense situation, which is where you really all are actually in the same boat. It's all like one umbrella organization that's going to be paying out the money and you're all really together, and hopefully you all can be a team if you're going to go to trial to defend something. But other times you've got multiple parties who all have very separate representation. It is this sort of dogfight, or it can turn into one, where you're trying to be like, you know, my person is totally blameless. That person over there shoulders all the blame, expecting the jury to be able to make these distinctions. Tell us about that.
Yeah, and it's really important, because you are right. When they're separate insurers, every insurance company's job is to protect their money and their insured. And so sometimes there is this sense amongst and between insurance companies that if anyone's going to pay on this case, it should be you paying 70% and I pay 30% and so forth. That's for the insurance company level. But for the client slash lawyer level, there were times where I represented two doctors at the same practice. And sometimes they would say, should I have separate representation? And I would say, if there was a conflict, if you had written in the chart that the other doctor messed up, then yes, there's absolutely, we don't want to be representing two people who are in conflict. But if there is no conflict, it makes so much sense for the attorney to represent the both people, because then you can have a collaborative defense. You can also have a collaborative defense when there are multiple lawyers, but you have to make sure that everyone's collaborative. I was fortunate. Most of the time, I really pushed for collaboration. I really did not want to have a reputation that I was a finger pointer. I worked really well with my co-defense counsel. And you consistently see the same people, right? It's not like you work with someone one time and then that's it. I represented a lot of OBGYN attendings, and I would always be with the same attorney who represented the residents from the hospital. And so we worked to collaborate. And when we couldn't, on those rare cases where there was a real conflict, we would resolve it between ourselves before we dealt with the plaintiff's attorney.
Yeah. That's actually one of the ugliest scenarios, which I hope to get to in a future podcast, but where it's sort of attending on resident violence, where they, like, you know, the attending and the resident have different perspectives and different representation and different insurers. And there can be this real temptation towards finger pointing that is not at all helpful.
It's not helpful in the case, and it's not helpful in the future. It hurts the providers. It hurts patients. Because if the providers don't trust each other, then they're going to be spending time covering their butts instead of taking care of the patient. So it's quite problematic across the board. But it can be prevented. It just takes some real intention from the moment you get the case.
And everybody deserves the emotions that you're talking about when they feel like they're being accused of something that they didn't do and they know actually it is the guy's fault. It is the person's fault. It is somebody's fault. But this is a conversation you should have openly with your attorney when this starts. They should know everything that you feel about this because, as I always try to teach people, like we've got these two realms to deal with, right? One is like processing the emotions and feeling all your totally legitimate feelings about this and figuring out what am I going to do with these feelings? How is this going to help me in the future? What am I going to do in my practice? Blah, 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 blah. But then there's what happens in the legal arena, which is totally separate, and learning how to operate in a way that is most strategic and advantageous to you in this environment. And this instinct to really very loudly blame somebody else may not be the most strategically wise thing for you to be doing, right? And so thinking very in a smart way about how do I represent this in the chart, in the deposition, et cetera, what is the wisest way to do that? That is going to pay dividends.
Yeah, and I love that word wise, right? Because wisdom takes some experience and some presence and intention and all of the things that our bodies don't want to let us do when we feel like we are in danger.
Can you give us some examples of real cases? I mean, protect people's confidentiality, obviously, but cases in your experience where, you know, blame shifting, finger pointing changed the outcome.
Yeah, I'll give you two examples with two extremes, and they were both OBGYN cases. Those cases, women often are asked to defend those cases. There aren't that many female trial attorneys out there.
You mean women are asked to defend OBGYN cases?
Yeah, because I think that there's an idea, and I don't know that it's true or not, but there's this idea that it will be easier for the jury to sort of understand things coming from a woman, and it might be more relatable. I'm not a mother, but the jury doesn't know that. And so it's part of the story of the defense thinking that, well, if we can have a female defend this case, it might be helpful. Right? Like a man cross-examining a woman about a very difficult labor and delivery. I mean, there are some phenomenal males who do a phenomenal job. I was called in a lot in OBGYN cases. I tried a lot of them. So early in my career, I had a case where I represented the attending. And when we met, the attending was frustrated with the resident's communication of what was going on with the strips. But I encouraged them to do their best not to be critical, to be factual, to say like, you know, this is the strip. And if asked, would you have liked to know that sooner? That's a question that often comes up, Gita, that you have to answer honestly, right? Yes, I would have liked to have known that sooner. In a perfect world, if everyone wasn't busy and taking care of other patients, yes, I would have liked to know that sooner. The attending did a beautiful job because we walked away and the attending felt very much like they had told their truth, that they had been consistent with what they wanted to say, without going all in fiery against the residents. However, when the residents testified, they were more critical of the attending. And I felt like that was really driven by the attorney who was relatively new to the scene and not the residents themselves. But see, that starts a very unpleasant snowball rolling. Yeah. Because now the attending is mad.
They will read those depositions.
And you have to tell them, even if they don't take the time to read it until we get to trial, you have to say, well, now we're in a different position. And then also you've got experts. And when you talk to the experts and you say, you know what, Dr. OBGYN, Dr. NICU, Dr. Pediatric Radiologist, we want to have a unified defense and come up with a way to defend this, even if it's focusing on causation and really be together. But then they hear that the residents went a little bit rogue. And then they're like, well, I can go rogue. And all of a sudden, it just turns into trying to herd cats. And one of the cats has already gotten away. And that case was going to resolve anyway. It was a terrible damages case. And in Philadelphia, terrible damages cases like those, while I have tried them, we often try to resolve them in a way that is financially sound. And this case ultimately resolved for more than I think it could have had we all been on the same page. And it impacted the relationship of the attending and the residents who had to continue to work together in the OB floor. And that's a big part of it as well, right? And that also leads to other litigation. If you don't trust each other and now you start documenting in a way that reflects that lack of trust, it's not like this is a one and done. You treat other patients. There are other complications. It's a bad form all around and it's unnecessary. So in another case, also an OBGYN case, but in this case, the way that it happened to work in this situation is the residents were insured through the hospital, so a different insurance tower, and the midwives were insured with the attendings. So the insurance tower that I was working with. And so because of that, the midwives were the ancillary staff in this particular case, and I represented the midwives and the attending, and we were able to work together to look at the chart and talk to the experts and all agree upon a unified defense. And one of the things we don't talk about enough with this is not only was that wonderful for the defense, we won the case, they were able to continue to work together in a beautiful way, but also, and really importantly, they were able to support each other through the trial. Instead of like, I see it when there's finger pointing in the trial, the people who work together every day are sitting on opposite sides of the courtroom and they're barely saying hello to each other in the galley. It's terrible. But if you can support each other through the trial, then you can often give metaphors or analogies or reminders that the other person might have forgotten. And it lends itself to much better testimony when you have that kind of support.
I think whenever we just get so angry and afraid and everybody, just recognizing everybody is out there trying to do their best and assuming like positive intent for everybody every step along the way. And even if they did something that you feel like maybe wasn't what you would do on a given day, at least like A, giving them the benefit of the doubt, and B, just assuming positive intent at the very, very least would go a long way.
I couldn't agree with you more. And I think that that carries on. People feel your energy. And when you assume good intent of the other providers, of the jurors, it serves you well.
Yes. Oh, of the jurors too. Yeah, for sure.
We could do a whole episode on that. That's a huge thing that I really don't want people, your listeners, to be afraid of jurors. It doesn't serve us.
I will. Yeah, we'll have to get back to that because I think that's a really great point. Okay. I want to come back to one other point that I think is very important just so that people, you mentioned it briefly in passing, but I think it's important to bring home. When there is a shared defense situation, right? You're all in the same insurance tower is insuring everybody, all the co-defendants. When there is a clear conflict of interest, you do need to talk about that because you really should have your own separate lawyer, but it's not so that you can throw each other under the bus.
No, you know, if there's a clear conflict of interest, it was very rare, Gita, but if I was representing someone and they said, I really think that that person acted below the standard of care, well, then I can't represent you both, obviously, because that would be not ethical for me. And so I will report that to the insurance company and one of the doctors or providers will get their own representation. And then in those types of cases, the ideal is to settle it. Because if you're at court and you've got a defendant saying another defendant acted below the standard of care, now the plaintiff doesn't even need their own expert. I mean, it really is a setup for a plaintiff's verdict. And the question is just number. And so in those situations, you know, you want to try to resolve the case so that you don't get to the point where you're trying to explain that at trial.
Let's talk about the jurors again. You said don't be afraid of jurors, right? They're good people who have good intent, right? And they want to actually, they take their jobs very seriously for the most part, I find. Except for the juror in my trial who fell asleep at 10 o'clock every morning. That bothered me.
They fell asleep. I will tell you that most of my trials, at least one juror falls asleep at some point.
So part of being a good witness is keeping people awake.
100%. 100%.
But for the most part, they want to do their job well. They may not understand everything that's happening. We'll hopefully have weeded out any obvious bias during the voir dire and all that kind of stuff. So hopefully you have a jury who wants to hear all the evidence. But of course, they make a lot of decisions that are based not only on the evidence that is being provided to them. They make determinations about what they feel about the person on the stand.
The thing that we have to remember, too, is your jurors are patients in the community. And they're going back to the community once the trial's over and talking about this. And so it leads to this further distrust of the medical system, which we already are really facing in a way that I have never seen in all of my years. It is a problem in the courtroom, but it's also a problem that carries on and probably leads to more litigation. Because if you're looking at a bunch of doctors who are all saying that the other doctors messed up, you're going to not feel safe in that hospital with those doctors or in that situation.
And also, I mean, say you're watching someone that you don't know and you're watching this scenario play out, right? And one person is just like, it's not my fault, it's their fault, their fault. If everyone did their jobs right, it would have been just fine. Maybe that person is right. Like, that could be true. But what do you feel about that person? Like, when you don't actually know what the truth is, like, what do you feel about that person? It's not, oh, that person must be right, let's side with them. It's a very different, like, I don't know, like, it feels kind of skeevy. Like, I don't want to watch that. This person makes me uncomfortable. Maybe they're not a good person. I don't know. It doesn't make you look good.
No. And I think, like, you got to remember that jurors are human. The best thing that they do is judge people's intentions and sort of the way that they are. And if you're there saying everybody messed up but me, they're not going to take that very well.
Yeah, they're going to read between the lines on that one. So let's wrap this up. If you could give every defendant just a piece of advice, the moment they're in a situation and they feel like they may in the future be blamed unfairly or they are being blamed unfairly for something, what advice would you give them?
So I'm going to split it into if you are in your clinical setting and you feel like there's a complication in the midst of happening and you feel as though, oh my gosh, I've got to blame somebody or they're going to blame me, I would encourage you to remember that chart is not the place to do that. Now, you may, when the clinical situation is over, want to bring it up the chain of command and talk about it in the quality review and any of those things. But on the chart, you want to stay very fact-oriented and specifics about the care of the patient. When it comes to litigation, the overall advice would be to take a deep breath because you want to move out of that fight flight into something that's a little bit more thoughtful. And you want to go from reacting to, oh my God, I'm going to be facing a jury and they're scary and this is scary. And if I can just blame someone else and it probably was their fault too, then I can get out of this. And you want to get out of reacting and go to responding. What is actually going on here? What is the medicine? What do the experts say? What does the other person say was the reason they did that particular thing? Because when that happens, so often, Gita, we find that the case is defensible and we win those cases. We win them because jurors want to do the right thing. And if you give them a reason to do the right thing, they will. But if you get all kinds of reactive and pointy and stressful and your energy is that, they feel that. And so take a deep breath. Talk to your attorney. Ideally, collaborate with the co-defendants so that you could get to a place where you are telling a coherent story to counter the other side's story of unsafe, disrespectful, terrible doctors.
Yeah. I often tell people when they're entering into this process, you know, there's a couple of uncomfortable truths. And one of them is if you come into this process expecting it to feel fair, you are going to be disappointed. Sometimes life is not fair. Litigation definitely does not feel fair sometimes. But once you're in it, the best thing you can do for yourself is to understand the lay of the land and what the most strategic, wisest way is for you to proceed working with your attorney. And sometimes it's not instinctually what you feel. Like lashing out may not be the wisest move. And so thank you for that. Yes, take a breath. Take some time. Talk to your attorneys. Tell them how you feel, process what you need to process, and then understand what is the wisest way for me to proceed at this point. And don't put it in a text.
please don't put it
in a text. Please don't text anybody. Don't do that. Just pick up the phone. I know it's hard for younger people, but just pick up the phone and call somebody. Heather, thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for bringing your expertise. And I'm sure we'll be hearing from you again.
My pleasure.
Thank you again, Heather Hansen, for your time and your expertise. Remember, as always, to defer to your own attorney's advice. This is not meant for legal advice specific to you. This is meant to be strictly informational and not directive. See you next month, everyone.